It's the 20th of June, 2002, in the location of Koinonia Fireside. And this evening, our presenter is Peter Thompson, and the forum title is Peace Patriotic While Our Country Is at War? Let's listen in.
Welcome, everyone, to this forum. Is peacemaking patriotic while our country is at war? My name is Peter Thompson, and I serve the village in the Resource Center. Since September 11th, we have had numerous events and meetings and activities around peace and related issues, as we have struggled as a community to do several things. Number one, to come up with a statement that we could agree to together. That was a real difficult time back in October, and we had a lot of discussion. There are a lot of different views here in the village. We instituted some other disciplines. You probably noticed the peacemaking announcements that are made once a day at mealtime. We have a prayer vigil for peace every Saturday night before Vespers. So if any of you aren't leaving Saturday, you're invited to that. We've had a peace group that has met every Wednesday night since September 11th to study various issues, study books, study forgiveness, other things. And I tell you all this for a good reason. That is that none of us pretend or have found all of the answers. Obviously, this world is in a lot of turmoil now, and one of the reasons we've had other forums and this forum is to hear views from different corners, from different perspectives, because we can all learn from hearing different views. And so it's in that spirit, and in an educational kind of spirit, that we come together here. And specifically, even before WordCamp started, they scheduled a peace forum because we thought we could learn substantial things from you. You come from many different geographic areas, many different walks of life. And so although there's four of us up here who will be doing some of the talking in the initial stages, most of this will be open. And so we would like to hear what you think about some of these issues. And to give the forum a little structure, we have drafted up some specific questions. I read them this morning at Matins time, posted somewhere on the dining hall, and I'll read them again now so you can be thinking about them. But I asked our three presenters here, who I think come from different perspectives, to focus on these questions or related topics that they would like to explain for about 5 minutes each. I will ask maybe some questions of each one, if there's something I think we could benefit by elaborating, or we could test some of the ideas a little bit. And then basically it will be an open forum, an open platform. So if anyone else wants to make a statement, elaborate on what they've heard, question what they've heard, but we don't want it to be ever personalized or try to make someone wrong or someone right. We all want to learn from this process. And so the topic tonight kind of emerged because Steve Clemens, who is here in attendance, he's not on the panel, but he's free to speak, as is anyone, gave a reflection last week on this night, Thursday night, our Peace Night Vespers. And he talked about many topics and a lot about his life in activism and how it came from his reading of Jesus' teachings and the Bible. Steve didn't mention it last week, but he's a lifelong Mennonite. And I just took one excerpt from his reflection, and it talks about this concept of empire. and Caesar, that you've probably heard Dan Erlander mention a couple of times this week before he left. And so I want to read this one part of his reflection. I want to read you the questions that I drafted that we aren't really bound to, but I think it's a good place to start from, that each of these three people will try and answer in a narrative fashion for 5 minutes. What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus when one's nation is at war? Today we live in a time of economic conscription. Although young men are still required to register for the draft, political leaders are hesitant to reestablish the draft for fear of waking a new generation to the realities of living in the American empire. Yes, at times we forget that we live in the empire. Although we'd like to identify with Moses and Miriam, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Jesus and the Marys of the Gospel, our situation as Americans places squarely in the role of the Persians, the Egyptians, the Roman Empire, the conquistadors, and a long list of oppressive empires that have come and gone. Now, the evening after Steve gave his reflection and the day after, there was a lot of conversations in the village, so I thought we could talk about some of these things. And so here are the two questions I've asked each of the panelists to address. Number one, is it unpatriotic to talk about the United States in these terms? And I had a couple little sub-questions there. One, if you did think it was unpatriotic, would it still be unpatriotic if your religious faith and beliefs is the basis for that talk, as opposed to just political banter? Two, is patriotism a good thing or a bad thing? And then the second large topic, is it fair to characterize the United States as an empire? So the panelists who will be addressing this are seated right next to me, Johannes Unz, who's 25 years old. He's a German, was educated there for a year and a half in German history and journalism. Then he studied 3 years in Leipzig theology, and then he studied 1 year here in Philadelphia at a Lutheran seminary. He's going back to Germany after he finishes to finish his study in 2 years, and his hope or goal is to become a pastor. Is that a Lutheran pastor, Johannes?
Yeah.
Next to my left is Ed Sikowski. He's from Valparaiso, Indiana. Ed is working up here right now as an electrician. Johannes, I should tell you, is working lots in gardens, yes. I think, right?
Weeding and watering.
Very good. Is it working? Good. Ed is a delegate to the 2003 ELCA Churchwide Assembly in Milwaukee. He is a 28-year veteran of the Naval Reserve. He's a blue and gold officer for the U.S. Naval Academy, and he has been a Boy Scout leader, he says, for more than 25, maybe 30 years. And Carol Masters is our last presenter. She is from Minneapolis, Minnesota. She's a mother of two, a grandmother of six. She is a poet and a fiction writer. She published a collection called, in 1994, The Peace Terrorist. And she has been active in terms of actually putting herself on the line since 1983. She was active in the Women's Peace Camp at Sperry Univac, which is a manufacturer of nuclear weapons, and they camped out on their corporate grounds until they were arrested and brought to court. So with that, before, Carol, were you gonna start? And then I thought Ed would go, and then Johannes, because I think he might have a little different perspective being from another country, we'd have him go last. But before we start, in the spirit of some of these concepts that I've mentioned in terms of education and openness, I'd like to just open with a brief prayer. Dear God, thank you for gathering us here in this peaceful valley. We all ultimately want the same thing for our families and our loved ones and ourselves. We want a peaceful world. We don't know how to get there. We're struggling. Please be with us here in this room as we try and learn from each other. Please give us patience. Please give us compassion for the views of others. And please give us the gift of listening. Help us to grow on the path that you have chosen for each of us in our own ways. Amen. So we'll start with Carol, then Ed, then Johannes.
I'm going to address the second question. Is it fair to characterize the United States as an empire? But first I'm going to start with not quite such a large concept, but a very small thing. And I'm dedicating this little reading I'm going to do from Barbara Kingsolver to the brush team today, who found many, many nests and saved one, at least. Steve saved one nest, and we all admired them. Barbara Kingsolver, this is her latest book. She is a novelist and an essayist. She is a naturalist and writes very often of the creatures of the world and brings them into her political and very creative viewpoints. And in this little essay, she is standing at her window. She's a writer and works at home and has the benefit of a window in her kitchen when she does the dishes. And as she's looking out, she sees a hummingbird. Hovering uncertainly. She held in the tip of her beak a wisp of wadded spider web, so tiny, I wasn't even sure it was there, until she carefully smooched it onto the branch. She vanished then, but in less than a minute, she was back with another tiny white tuft she stuck on top of the first. For more than an hour, she returned again and again, increasingly confident of her mission, building up by infinitesimal degrees a whitish lump on the branch and leaving me plumb in awe of the supply of spider webbing on the face of the land. I stayed at my post, washing everything I could find, while my friend did her own housework out there. When the lump had grown big enough, when some genetic trigger in her small brain said, "Now that will do," she stopped gathering and sat down on her little tuffet, waggling her wings and tiny rounded underbelly to shape the blob into a cup that would easily have fit inside my cupped hand. Then she hovered up to inspect it from this side and that, settled and waddled with greater fervor, hovered and appraised some more, and dashed off again. She began now to return with fine filaments of shredded bark, which she wove into the webbing, along with some dry leaflets and a slap dab or two of lichen pressed onto the outside for curb appeal. When she'd made of all this a perfect symmetrical cup, she did the most surprising thing of all. She sat on it, stretched herself forward, extended the unbelievable length of her tongue, and licked her new nest in a long upward stroke from bottom to rim. Then she rotated herself a minute degree, leaned forward, and licked again. The hummingbird continues all the way around the nest, one little degree at a time until she's covered the whole thing. If you had been me standing with me at my, or if you had been standing with me at my kitchen sink to witness all this, you would likely have breathed softly as I did, "My God." The spectacular perfection of that nest, that tiny tongue, that beak calibrated perfectly to the length of the tubular red flowers from which she sucks nectar and takes away pollen, to commit the essential act of copulation for the plant that feeds her, every bit of this thing and all of it, my God. You might be expressing your reverence for the details of a word created in 7 days, 4,004 years ago, by a divine being approximately human in shape, or you might be revering the details of a world created by a billion years of natural selection, acting utterly without fail on every single life form, one life at a time. For my money, the latter is the greatest show on earth, and a church service to beat all. Barbara Kingsolver uses the hummingbird to talk about biodiversity, all the wonderful life forms in our created world, and the way that variation in traits sustains our life. At the root of everything is genetic diversity, and at the root of this, of course, we all know and don't talk about a lot, is sex. I'm not going to talk a lot about sex in this, but takes two people coming together, two life forms coming together and bringing their seeds and their egg together to create myriads of forms. Then she tells us that we should be a little bit nervous about genetic engineering. She cites the example of BT corn. A number of you are probably a lot more familiar with this than I am. But when scientists spliced part of the DNA of BT bacterium into the DNA of corn, the bacterium explodes the stomachs of caterpillars, which the scientists believe would help out the corn and help feed the world a little bit better. And it worked pretty well. Too well for a time, but because the corn pollen of this super combo is very effective, its rearranged life managed to destroy life populations of butterflies, monarch butterflies, and other insects, and the natural predators of corn in such a way that resistance super mutations are taking over. So what does this have to do with empire? Some other questions. What does this have to do with empire? Who controls the world's narrowing seed banks? What is happening with biodiversity? Why should we worry that it's being reduced? Why do a handful of agribusinesses create chemical dependencies in developing countries? Why are millions of farmers leaving the land in this country, around the world? And why don't we hear about these facts of life that have everything to do with survival, not only for human beings? But if our food supply is being reduced, shouldn't that matter to us? Why isn't it on television in sound bites every 5 minutes? A few statistics. You and I belong to the 20% of the world population that controls 67% of its resources. We sell and develop and use more weapons than the next 6 industrialized nations. United States is 5% of the world population, and it uses a quarter of its fuels. We bombed Iraq in 1991, as we all know. And 11 years later, 5,000 children are dying every month in Iraq of treatable diseases and malnourishment. What American uses goods that would support 30 citizens of India? The average food item that is set on our table has traveled about 1,500 miles to get there. Well, I think I'll stop there, and I have another little bit that I'd like to go into, because Barbara Kingsolver wrote this book after and as a response to September 11th. Not all of the essays are ostensibly about September 11th, but all of them relate in some way.
Okay. Yeah, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. I may have some questions, but maybe I'll hear the other things you have to say and see which way we're going.
I've had a couple of days to think about this. In fact, I was working up around the compost pile on some running some underground today, and I guess I wasn't paying attention because I didn't turn off electricity. And you know what they call us electricians, twidgets, because I could twidget a little bit until I realized that electricity is still on. So I thought, and hopefully my questions or my comments will make some sense at the end here. I was looking over the questions, and I was having a little difficulty with some of the terms, and especially the empire. And I looked in the dictionary, and an empire was many countries controlled, ruled by one body, and I guess I was having a little trouble with that. And I felt maybe initially I would be attacking some of Steve's comments that he made, so I thought I'd take a little different turn of things. And it used to be that, and if I attacked Steve, I'm sure that I would turn off probably a number of you folks, and I don't want to do that. Years ago, Congress used to boast that 70% of the Congress had been veterans, and today that is less than 25%. So a lot of the Congress people, and those are the ones who kind of are the ones who determine if there's going to be peace or war, because really the military are the ones who, we're the ones who do fight the wars or fight the battles, and Congress is the one who declares peace or war. On that. And in fact, some of us naval officers said that if the military had to choose between peace and war, there'd be a lot fewer wars, because we're the ones who have to go through a lot of the pain and suffering and discomfort of the war and being away from our families and things. And I'm sure that if I would pull this room of men, I probably would come up with maybe a third of you had been in the military at some time or another. And I won't, you know, I don't want to polarize you there with doing that. And I think a lot of times, because few people are involved in the military, probably a lot of you really don't understand what happens in the military. And so I thought I'd approach it by that. And really, the military is very similar to Holden Village, because there's barracks, there's a dining hall, there's central drill hall like the village center, there's laundries, there's medical, there's chapels, and much of the work is shared amongst the enlisted with the chiefs and the officers as the leaders, and we have leaders here as well. There's various work assignments with work centers. Mm-hmm. And the hours usually are about 7 to 4, and with Saturdays and Sundays for rest, relaxation, and worship. And each of the bases and units is like a community, and there's a great deal of pride about belonging to that community, to that unit, or that squadron, or that ship, or whatever. And they're working on various assignments, and evenings, usually the enlisted and the chiefs and the officers kind of go their own way, very different here than the Golden Village. Those of people who go on a military base, and I know my wife used to go on active duty with me in the reserves, and she felt a certain amount of belonging. You know, the people on there, you know, you kind of felt something in common with them. Well, in November 99, I turned 60 and reached the mandatory retirement age. Before I retired, I was an executive officer of a reserve unit and the lead instructor in naval officer leadership, and was the coordinator for our total quality management program. And the Navy calls it TQL, total quality leadership. In a way, it was kind of turning many of the companies that you maybe are employed, kind of turning the company upside down and finding out what the people who were, where the rubber hit the road, what was happening. And the interesting thing is that the Naval Officer Leadership class was really a course on ethics. And that was kind of doing the right thing. The Navy learned from its past mistakes that officers need to periodically stop and see if their actions are the right thing to do in that particular situation. I'll pull my paper here for my notes. We did a lot of reviewing of things that were written. We talked about the Ten Commandments, the Golden Rule, and other things that we learned at home, in school, and church to help us make ethical decisions. And as those of you who have been enlisted, if you took the oath of office, you were to follow the orders of your superiors. However, military officers take the same oath that the President and Congress take, and they are to defend and to support the Constitution of the United States. I thought maybe that would be some interesting thing that you might want to know. So in other words, we are in a position to make decisions on certain things. If something isn't right, to be able to write it as a military officer. And also something that at least one of the sessions we discussed, that the Constitution, because we're supposed to defend and to support the Constitution, is that the First Amendment reads that it is the freedom of religion, not the freedom from religion, because a lot of people sometimes think in schools and things that separate the church and state. Now, I'm not sure that I had the same patriotic feeling during my first 6 years that I had the last 22. Long story short, as I was in the reserve in high school, active duty for 4 years, and I stayed out 15 years, and then came back in the reserves after I finished my degree at Valpo. And I think probably when I achieved the rank of Chief Petty Officer, that I felt that I was protecting the citizens and the freedoms we Americans have. I have no doubt that I would have given my life, that my family and friends and the citizens of this country would continue to enjoy those freedoms. My scouting taught me the scout oath, and it says, on my honor, I will do my duty to God and my country and help others at all times. And I feel that the naval service and my service to God are harmonious and are not in conflict. In effect, Romans 13 clearly states how a Christian submits himself to authority. And Karen, could you read part of that, Matthew, or Romans 13?
Just cut me off. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. For rulers have no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do not want to be free from fear of one authority, of one in authority. Then do what is right, and he will commend you. For he is God's servant to do you good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an agent of wrath, to bring punishment on the wrongdoer.
There's just a little bit more. Okay, go ahead.
Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of the possible punishment, but also because of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants. We give their full time to government. Give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor.
Yeah, and on the other one, and I'll just give it to the short version, it's Matthew 22, is give to Caesar what is Caesar's and what to God, which is God. And that's why I think the two are harmonious. Now, also, I kind of remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs, because the first in the list of psychological or physiological needs is food, water, and air for human survival, and next is security, shelter, clothing, and feeling safe. And I feel that the police and the fire and the military provide that basic human need for safety. And I was thinking tonight when I was in Vespers, safety, peace, they might be similar. Much of Holden Village is protected by a fire detection system and all the buildings, and there is a trained fire brigade to extinguish any fire that would happen in the village, and that's part of us feeling safe. And I guess just to wrap up my comments, I feel that God helps him who helps himself with the intellect and the skills to provide their human needs as well as to protect and defend themselves. Many of the military leaders are very open in their reliance to God and his commandments. At one time in the late 1980s, the Lutherans dominated the military chaplain corps. The senior chaplain for all of the military was a Lutheran, and each one of the services had their senior chapter, their senior chaplain was a Lutheran. And we were never taught to kill in order to, or indiscriminately. In fact, they were very specific about rules of engagement. A lot of what the military does is readiness in case something does happen, because most of us in the military would not want to see the draft come back, because all the folks that are there because they want to be. And the way technology is today, there's no time to recruit and train people. What you have is what you have to defend the country. And I'll end there.
Okay. Maybe I'll ask you a couple questions, and I'll come back and ask Carol some questions when she gets time to figure out just exactly where she's finishing. When you say you would never be trained to kill in an indiscriminate manner, what if the weapon that you were trained to use would do so? In other words, I know there's talk now about all sorts of huge new bombs. You know, personnel cluster bombs were used in Afghanistan, which I know killed a lot of kids. There's a manufacturer of landmines in our backyard in Edina, Minnesota, that has manufactured a lot of landmines, and they're generally thought to kill, especially after war is over, more civilians than combatants. What if, as part of your order, you say that it was harmonious for you, this call between your God and your political leaders? What if those weapons were indiscriminate, like some of these weapons? What would you do if that harmony didn't exist?
Well, sometimes when you give an order, you don't have the opportunity to at least know all the information. You know, it's like Monday morning quarterbacking. However, I think, I guess the answer is that civilians are civilians and military targets are military targets. And I guess sometimes if the enemy wants to put civilians around there, maybe many times we don't know that there's civilians that are clustered around where the military are. So I think a lot of times probably it's an afterthought to know whether there were civilians in that location or not.
How about a weapon of mass destruction?
Well, like the atomic bomb.
In fact, as long as you mentioned that, President Truman made a statement after the first atomic bomb was dropped, and he said, "We chose to drop this bomb yesterday, the most glorious day in American history, because we dropped it on a military target." And of course, he dropped it on a city, which had some military institutions, but it destroyed all the citizens in the city. If you'd known those facts and you were in the bomber, can you envision a time when you'd have to make a choice between these two authorities?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I guess I can't see a blanket statement, but there are times that a military officer or a military person can opt out on something, and sometimes they can. And other times they have an opportunity to add some other information. I think that's why the military has kind of changed its tactics. Instead of "I say you do," that's why they've come up with some of these ways of getting as much information as possible from the people who are pulling the triggers or dropping the bombs and things. So I think it's a different military than it was during the Second World War.
Johannes?
Yeah, it's very interesting too. I can start with the German background is after the Second World War as a destroyed nation, knowing about where authority can lead if we subdue automatically or without conscious under authority, like the German people was not bad by itself. I mean, most of you know the history, so I don't have to go into this, but it's necessary that we question the authority we are living under, and authority is also necessary to organize life. That's what Roman 13 is saying. I wanna start with a couple of impressions about patriotism, and the symbol of patriotism is the flag. And we in Germany, we don't have so much flags like in the United States. I want to use two images. The first is after I came to the States 3 weeks before September 11th, or 4 weeks. And the day after September 11th, I was biking through the neighborhoods, and I was seeing all these flags, and I thought, what are all these flags about? Probably this is something like an American holiday I don't know about yet. I was going back to the seminary and I asked someone, he said, yeah, it's because September 11th and solidarity and people are... So that shows how when you're from another country and something like this happens, I didn't have the real feeling what's going on. Step by step, I get into it and talking with people and so on. But this flag is the represent is kind of like a link through the whole country when you're traveling, and in the stores and everywhere, it's kind of a little ID that is connecting the whole country. And I was very upset when I entered the church, my field at church, and I saw a flag inside the church. I consider this as offensive from a German background, because we had the Hakenkreuz flag, the flag of Hitler in the churches, and we remember the times when the church was abused by the government, or was abusing itself in some cases. So it was hard for me to accept the flag in the sanctuary first. I saw a lot of good Christian in churches with flags, so I don't want to say that it is wrong. But for me, I would never I would never, if I would be a pastor in a church, it would for me very hard to accept the flag, because this symbol is the symbol of a authority, and authority is always a hierarchical system, even if it's a democracy. And this hierarchical system does not represent for me the so-called manna society of the Bible. So this is my personal impression about the flag. And about patriotism, I was thinking, who decides what patriotism is? If somebody shuts off the discussion because he says this is not patriotic, he has the power to put topics on the agenda, which topic he wants to talk about. He decides what patriotism is, and the other person has no possibility to answer, because he is credibility anymore, because he's not patriotic, whatever this means. The other person has already decided. So this is a shut off argument. If somebody uses this, you know that he wants to shut off. Now, after this bit harsh opening, I want to just go into some observations I made, and a bit into the history about how Germany perceives America. The relationship between America and Germany is very ambivalent. We, on the positive side, we knew in Germany pretty well what America does for us after the Second World War. A lot of old people remember the packages with food sent by Lutherans a lot. And the American soldiers were the most friendly soldiers. The air bridge to Berlin in the 60s, all these things where we are pretty aware that America is the strong protector of West Germany against the evil Russian Empire. And and I think we are still thankful for this. I mean, it sounds probably a bit curious for you to hear this, but it's pretty amazing that another country gives its lives for a system like the Third Reich after this has happened to help people. This is amazing. On the other side, there was this long anti-American feelings. I don't know how far they go back. Germany as a country in the midst between Russia and the Western world had always strong relations to Russia. Anti-Vietnam movement in the 60s was strong. It was a strong anti-atom bomb movement in Germany, where the church was very involved, the stationing of the Pershing 2 rockets. I don't know if you have questions. If I say something wrong, you can ask. And I was about 12 or 13 when we demonstrated about the Gulf War. I don't know if there was demonstrations in America, but we were against the Gulf War. And yeah, these two sides I think are important. That we need America in the NATO as a strong military partner, as a strong economic partner. Germany produces most of its goods for export. It's an export country, so it is very important that you buy German cars. another point is that is something probably new for you, or I hope, is the what I would consider as cultural imperialism. When I came to the States, it was like, for me, the first couple of weeks was kind of coming to a movie set, because I knew all this from the movies, but I've never been there. And the movies are very important. 80% of the movies in Germany are Hollywood blockbusters in the cinemas. The pop music, rock and roll music, are probably 90% in the radio. Are American pop and English pop music, English in the English language. Well, fast food, McDonald's, like everywhere. What else? Do you have something on my list? Yeah, consumerism at all. The whole youth culture, MTV, we are using a lot of Anglicism, English words in our vocabulary in Germany, especially advertising, because that's cool. And we say cool in Germany too.
With a K.
And there's already a society who tries to protect the German language from the bankruptcy of English language. So this cultural imperialism has both sides. The strong, we want all this American stuff because it's cool, and this also we don't want to be Americanized. We have the saying, these are American circumstances, as this is something, not so good. Do you want to shut up?
Yeah, I want to ask you a question. Do you see both good and bad in our economic power in the United States? And then the next question is, do you see both good and bad in our military might?
Yeah, I would say so.
Explain the good and the bad in the military might.
For example, the Balkan policy, Euro was pretty weak during this time, and America stepped in and did a good job. Also, the engagement of the Balkan, I don't know if you're familiar to this.
Yugoslavia.
I have to say, I grew up in West Germany, so there were American soldiers. We were a kind of an occupied country, it was kind of weird. Three different armies and the German army. I would say this kind of Western freedom in Germany is because there were the allies of the army in Germany who protected us from the Soviet Union. I mean, the border was through Germany. I mean, I lived 3 years in the eastern part of in the former GDR. So my mother comes from the GDR. So, I mean, I know pretty well the differences between the two systems, and I'm pretty glad that I grew up in West Germany in a lot of sense, because this is the Western freedom. Yeah.
Let me ask you, in Jesus' teachings, in your study of the New Testament, would you think it would be fair to call it basically as pacifism in terms of violence and nonviolence?
Jesus' theology?
And the way he lived his life.
I think generally, yes, but I think we should be careful that we don't put Jesus in a peace corner, because he was very harsh. And I think pacifism and non-violent movement is also violent in making a statement. Like Martin Luther King, it is a violence if you sit on another property, even if you don't do anything violent. Just sitting there is also a violation. I would say this is already violence. And from this standpoint, Jesus was violent, because he went into properties which were not his own. At least death was the last one he went into. So he violated the boundaries of society.
Carol, is trespass violence, do you believe?
No, I don't believe that it's violence. I would define violence in another way as injuring another person, another.
Yeah, I agree with it, but it is considered as violence in our society.
I don't want to get you off the seat of questions, Carol, so could you finish and I'll ask you a couple questions and then I may just open it up here.
Yeah, the only other story that I wanted to tell was about September 11th and the deaths of all those people affecting us so deeply in a very personal way. Because even those of us who didn't know anyone there or a relative of anyone there, it awakened in us the immensity of what is wrong in our society. My reaction when it was asked on the TV screen, How can we respond? How can we respond ethically, morally, to this horrible thing that happened? And my response was, repent. There's a reason why we were the targets, why the United States symbols of power, the Pentagon, the World Trade Center was attacked. The story I wanted to tell was about Ruth Rosenblum, who was the sister of one of the people who died in the World Trade Center. She came to Minneapolis a couple of months ago on Mother's Day and gave a little talk about her brother, and she had pictures of him. And he was a really loving family person. And she, of course, she was angry about this hole in her life, in her family's life, that she'll be living with for the rest of hers. But she knew that her brother would not be vindicated by revenge, by killing other people. And she joined a delegation of the families of those who were killed to go to Afghanistan, and this was several months after September 11th, and speak to families there of those who had been killed. And that's what I think forgiveness, reconciliation is about.
Would you, Carol, think that any sort of military response would be appropriate to what happened on September 11th?
I can't claim to be a total pacifist. I'd strive to that, but I hope that some police action could find the people who were responsible for planning the attack and bring them to a court of justice.
And if that may entail some violence, you'd anticipate? Be possible.
I would expect so.
Peter, you'd asked me a question before, and I didn't think I answered it very well, and I kind of was going back to when I learned something as far as in scouting. One of the scout laws or points is obedience. And I have my scout book with me because it's got birds and flowers and stuff like that. But it says here, obedience is to follow the rules of family, school, troop, obey the laws of the country and community. If you think that these rules and laws are unfair, try to change them in an orderly manner rather than disobeying them. And I think that probably, in answer to your question you gave me, that there is, rather than disobeying them, try to change them in an orderly manner.
What if there can be a lot of tough gray areas in life? What if you were on Lieutenant Calley's group and he had some Vietnamese women and children and Calley said shoot them?
I think that in the military, those decisions are made even in non-combat situations, that something isn't right. Could be someone harassing a female, whether it be a civilian or someone in the military, and that you stop, and or someone using some language that is not appropriate. And I think those are the times that you take over and you say this is not right.
What do any of you think about patriotism or empire, Dean? I'll just kind of pick people as I see you first. So I've seen a couple. Yes.
A lot of people think that real patriotism is blindly following the decisions of our leaders and supporting them. My feeling is not that. That true patriotism is having the courage to be responsible as a citizen and help point out any problems or inconsistencies or policies that are not appropriate. And I just read John Adams' biography. It's a good example of someone who at times disagreed rather vigorously with some of our nation's policies, and yet worked vigorously to change them in the right direction. That's true patriotism, not blind folly.
Thank you. Jeremy, next. You can put your hand up so I can kind of scope you out a little bit if you're interested.
It seems to me that one of the themes that's come out of everything is the police state, the police aspect of internationalism in our lives, and the safety aspect, the divide between authority, where we follow it, where we don't. And it seems to me that a long time ago we used to talk about this idea of international police force, and that this, should America use troops to be kind of the international cops of the world, which we're thinking that all of us kind of agree that is necessary in some way, perhaps. We admit that even in some forms of enforcing rules, there might be violence that comes about it. But this idea of international police force, or even the American troops involved in the international police force, it seems to me that maybe, I'd like to think it was dismissed as kind of authoritarian, but I think it actually just got put aside a little bit. And someone else thought, pulled it out and thought, hey, this would be a great idea to just do this without being international about it. And we'll just take away kind of all the problems that everybody out there has with quelling internal debate. And we'll send our troops wherever we want to in the entire world. We'll call it a war. We'll get the Congress to give us a very broad statement about what war is, so we can go out and pursue wherever we like. And we will say to those people that we can do this because our society produces all these freedoms, all these great things that we have, we keep going with, all of the things, the biochemical problems that she was discussing. And so we say to these countries, we're going to send our troops everywhere, kill whoever we feel like, and we'll save you the trouble of quelling internal debate. And the only thing you have to give up is you just have to imprison like a quarter, you know, population, and keep other people under wraps in economic straits because they don't have the ability to advance up into higher levels of society. But if you just follow that policy, we don't have to worry about international police force anymore. We just have the American police force. It feels to me that the military aspect has become that.
Anybody want to respond to that? Multilateralism as opposed to unilateral action? That particular topic, Ed?
Yeah. I think you'll notice that the Congress did not want to police Afghanistan. I mean, and that was, they didn't want to be a police force. So I think there are some people in Congress who are not wanting to be the policemen of the world.
Peter?
Yeah, Ben.
This morning on the news, I was hearing from the president on down, members of the administration talking about and making, even not revealing the timeline, but saying there is a timeline that would possibly involve preemptive nuclear strikes on a number of countries as kind of a policing of weapons of mass destruction. And that's so frightening enough for me as an American, but then I'm trying to imagine what that would feel like. I'm trying to imagine another country unilaterally deciding they can preemptively strike anywhere in the world with nuclear weapons, and imagining their people not rising up and saying no to that is really frightening. And so I wonder about that with my own faith here. How can I get myself in front of that train, which feels like a real runaway to me?
Anything else on the unilateral?
I was going to say, well, it's out of vogue at right now to oppose JW. You're either with us or you're against us. There's no middle ground.
Ken?
Dietrich Bonhoeffer participated in a plot to kill the leader of his nation. I'd like to ask the panelists to respond to the ethical and moral implications of his activity, particularly thinking about, was it patriotic?
Okay, well, I'd ask, did any of the panelists want to respond to that? Johannes?
I can good respond to that. It was absolutely patriotic. It was the most patriotic act at this time. It was, David Bonhoeffer said that if a driver drives around and kills people and is with his car, what are you doing? Are you going for the injured people, or are you trying to get rid of the rider of this car, of the driver? We have to be, disobedience is our responsibility to worldly systems. I think that does not mean that we are disobedient all the time. We are in our community, in our local community, in our regional community, in our state community, in our world community. We are in a lot of different authorities and systems, family up to state, and I think we live in a relationship. So we pay taxes, and the state provides us streets. We have to get back to this thinking. But if I pay taxes and I get nothing for it, then I live in this Egypt society, I would say. And as the statistics have shown, that we are in this pyramid at the top, and two-thirds of the world are at the bottom. And I want to give a little different slide to this. The freedom I grew up in, West Germany, the so-called Western values, are questionable. The American Constitution is not the ending of all ethics, and the German Grundgesetz is not the truth. We learn this in dialogue with other countries, with other cultures, and since the 18th century, we think we have found the real truth, and this as the foundation, or as the reason for our actions in the world. I think we can see that our truth we have found in the human rights, like we pursue it, is not really working yet in our own countries. In Germany and in America, I was surprised how many problems America has. I was working in an African-American community. And I think America, the United States, I have to say, can learn a lot by working inside. I think we have the saying in Germany, first you have to clean up in the door in your own house before you go outside. And
great, thanks. Do you have a comment, sir?
No.
Okay, Justin.
One of the basic questions you asked, Peter, was is the United States an empire? I think one of the things that's important to remember is that Washington was built on seven hills, just as Rome was built on seven hills, and that the United States was formed very much out of the Enlightenment and neoclassical age, and the inspiration of Rome and all the positive values associated with Rome were very much in the minds of the founders of the American nation. And in Paul, you see that there is also recognition that empire itself is not an entirely negative entity. However, but in the sense that we are in these various chains of authority, there is the recognition that God's authority is above the imperial authority. And one of the things that my parents were Americans who decided to come to Canada in 1970 because of the bombing of Cambodia. And that was a decision based on the fact that they felt that an authority with which they very much felt allegiance to and very much a part of and very much believed in the values that it represented no longer represented the values that they had been come to believe it represented. And I think even when we look at the church, this is a question we most constantly ask, is that on the assumption that we are a part of this authority because it has stated values that we believe in, are we actually upholding those values? So what I would say is when you look at at one's national values, first of all, the question is, do you agree with those, what are those values, and do you agree with them? And do the actions of that nation support or undermine those values?
If our country, Carol, does something you disagree with, do you at times think you should disobey the law? And if so, in what kind of parameters?
Well, I have done it, as you know. I mean, in civil disobedience is disobeying the law, whether in service to a higher law or just to make a statement that many of this country's people say no to the deep violence of this nuclear threat.
Before you did that, did you write to your congressional leaders and try the usual ways?
Oh, sure.
And the orderly approach that you talked about that was right in that Scouts Oath, if someone has tried all the regular approaches and hasn't stopped something they think is immoral, would Carol's divine obedience be an orderly approach?
Well, I guess never is never, and always is not always. I guess I'm thinking of how many people in this room don't vote. I mean, there's an opportunity to change things, or how many elected officers, and I tell everybody I have the lowest political office in the county. I'm a precinct committee member. It doesn't pay me anything, but I'm still involved with the controlling what happens in my community, and I hear people are damning politics, don't want to get involved in politics, and the way to change something is jump in, you know, in the water and get involved.
How about when Gandhi changed the entire British ownership of the subcontinent by going outside of the law? Do you think there's times when it is an orderly and proper fashion for change?
I'm sure there is, but I don't support that. I support trying to change it orderly.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Take it closer to home, or case closer to home. How about the blacks in the southern states of America that were disenfranchised, had no way to participate in the political process? The only way they could do it was essentially massive resistance. If they hadn't done that, we would still have segregated places in the South.
Anyone got a response to that? We are over time.
And I've heard that, especially from Johannes here, that, and I think from Justin too, that we're really looking for the truth. Is there anyone that could give us a statement to wrap it all up? All right, we have three applicants here. We've heard from you two guys, so we're going to hear the truth right here.
No, that's not true.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to sneak something in there.
Okay, go ahead. We won't hold you to the ultimate truth.
Okay.
Do we have to stop, or could this continue when people want to leave?
This could continue. I just want people to feel free to leave, since we've already spent more than our hour.
I just wanted to mention that as far as identifying these are the bad guys or the evil guys, and these are, if you want to put it black and white, these are the more proper people, and they used to come in the rules of engagement to a field, and they had uniforms on, and you knew which was this side and which was that side, and they went out in some unoccupied area and did battle. And over the years, the rules of engagement, which are somewhat written, have been so totally ignored that it's really hard to have a clean war anymore. And I'd like Ed to respond to that according to what he's been taught.
Well, I don't want Ed to be the repository of all Christians, but
yeah.
I mean, if anyone here would like to try and respond to that. I know the Catholic Church did a study of the Gulf War, and they concluded that it was not a just war, and the just war theory still exists, but they said because of the nature of weapons used, it would be hard to imagine any war in the future qualifying under the just war theory.
Yeah. But let's go beyond that. Let's say we will kill for oil. We would not be in Kuwait if it wasn't for the oil. Mm-hmm. We will kill for oil. We won't cut our consumption by 20%. We will kill for oil. That is satanic. That's everything that's been talked about over there. That the gauntlet is down. There is a group of people who are calling this and saying, this is satanic, and the church needs to respond to it. And we're beating around the bush in these discussions without really diving into that core. And I firmly believe that if most people in this country spent 20 hours researching or listening to certain people, they would weep bitterly about what is going on.
But Peter, aren't we also complicit in the dominant culture? Because if you want to make oil go away, you should not drive a car, right?
Well, maybe you should say you should use less, or you should use some appropriate percentage of that amount. But I think we are ignoring the voice of Jesus. What happened to all the "What Would Jesus Do" stickers? I don't know if that's popular in Minnesota, but around here, WWJD was all over the place until after September 11th. I've seen three of them since then. And the reason is that Jesus would not do what we are doing.
Okay, Johannes would like to respond.
Yeah, I just want to make a final close of it. I think as Christians, I see our main task in making ourselves vulnerable. This is something, this is against all human systems, because vulnerability means that we have to give away arms, control, and that by chance the people we once oppressed gonna oppress ourselves. And this is pretty risky. And I pray that I can do it in my own life. I can only start with myself. I invite everybody to do the same.
You sure could.
For me, though, to be honest, I think it has to go beyond the individual statement.
Before you guys leave, and we'll come back, I would like to really have everyone acknowledge the three, Carol, Ed, and Johannes, particularly Ed, because he obviously was in a tough situation here. I told him, we were talking about doing this, I said, for me, And you can probably tell, since Steve and Carol are my good friends, my leanings, I kind of feel intimidated on the outside now. And I said, so Ed feels probably a little bit that way here at Holden. So I would just like to thank very much all three for being able to be willing to share their views here. Anyone wants to stay around to discuss a little more, that's fine. I'll stay here.
There's a service at 10 o'clock.
Oh, yeah. So, but we can do like 10 more minutes if you'd like. And Steve?
But on this issue of vulnerability, I think it's very important that we as individuals be willing to be vulnerable. But what about our institutions? And the United States as a nation has said publicly that we refuse to sign any treaties that will put us in subjection to the International Court of Justice. And so there has to be the institutional component as well as the individual component. And until we as a nation are willing to say that we will be subject to the rule of law internationally, the no matter what we do as individuals is really, it's not insignificant. I think it's always significant what we do, but it has to be coupled with that institutional response as well.
Steve, are you referring to after 9/11?
Yes, the president, no, it was before 9/11, but since then, President Bush has made it very clear that we will not sign onto the International Court of Justice because, and he stated, we never want to have U.S. military subject to the rules and regulations of other nations. Mm-hmm. That never will U.S. military be under the command of someone else. And that kind of arrogance is, for me, the epitome of what it means to be part of the empire. That we are saying we play by our rules and everybody else has to agree to our rules. We will not agree to the international community's rules.
Well, Peter, do you draw contracts?
Chris, did you want to respond?
I did. I mean, in general, I feel like the U.S. being incredibly unilateral in the last few years, especially. But this International Court of Justice, I just want to pose the question, I mean, whose definition of justice is that? What institution are we trusting to come up with those rules? We have a very complex and delicately balanced judicial system in the U.S. that has a lot of rules put into it for pretty good reasons. And if we say that above that is an international court of justice with a completely differently derived system determined by, I don't know, the UN, then it's a little bit of handing control to somebody that we don't know who.
But the U.S. Constitution says that international law is, in fact, the supreme law of the land. It's already in our Constitution. The problem is that our courts don't recognize it. And so even though it's there in the Constitution, no one's, at this point, ready to say that we are going to be bound by it. We've signed international treaties about rules of engagement and appropriate targets in war and things like that, and yet how do we enforce them?
To answer your question, Chris, the place the International Criminal Tribunal comes from is the UN. Right. So it's supposedly from, you know, the ultimate in multilateral, multinational, and they pass resolutions creating the court, then the court promulgates their rules and develops the rules of evidence and defines the different crimes.
That's true, but a three-judge panel can decide to bring a case to that court. The rules are in some cases seem actually pretty blunt, you know, and maybe not too well defined.
Well, there isn't any question that we would be submitting ourselves to other than our own judicial system if we signed on to the court. That would be something we'd be giving up. What we'd be gaining is the multilateralism that, you know, people are talking about here.
Jim?
Jonathan.
And my whole catch with that, though, is that we're expecting other countries to follow that when we ourselves are not willing to submit ourselves to that.
But we're not expecting them to follow it. I mean,
well, but when we talk about doing these preemptive nuclear strikes and things, that's saying that we're not trusting in what they're doing. So, you know, we're going to take things into our own hands while not submitting ourselves to that system.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about the preemptive nuclear strikes. That's,
but, yeah, I want to say something about the Kyoto Treaty. I don't know how, Kyoto contract. I was still in Germany. I think it was in August or July when the United States get out of the Kyoto Treaty. And this really, I mean, in Germany especially, is against Bush and against Bush politics that he gets out of these treaties. It's not the treaty, it's not what is said in the treaty that to reduce the exhaust of this percentage. It's that the nation, all nations acknowledge, or the important industrial nations acknowledge that there is a problem and that this treaty is needed, because on the basement of this treaty, others treaty can make. But without the United States, it's not really the same thing. I mean, I think you said a quarter of the pollution is done by the States. And I think also the United States stepped out of a biological chemical program where they were forced to reduce their weapons or something like this.
Okay, we've got two other hands here. We'll take those and then we'll wrap it up because they're going to do Compline here in a couple minutes.
Briefly, I think one of the things we haven't talked about is our economic imperialism. And that's the thing that concerns me almost as much, if not more, than war itself. Somebody mentioned up here, it's not vogue to go against Bush. Well, Christians have never been in vogue. I mean, that's par for the course. And I think we have to stand, not drive SUVs, not use oil, and really start looking at where do we do our shopping and how do we handle the economic imperialism that we have at this point. And other countries are looking to see when are we going to fall. And I think this is a very important part of our world.
Justin, you got the last draft here.
Earlier we were talking about briefly talking about the just war. I thought it reminds me of the concept from a theologian and political scientist, Isaiah Berlin, and he talked about what does it mean to be made in God's image, and it means, and he determined that it meant to be in the position of God to make tragic choices. So just as God makes the tragic choice to let his people have a king, so as human beings, we oftentimes are in situations where we are faced with a dilemma, where we have a course of action, where the necessity has dictated that our two choices go against God's will. And I think what becomes a problem is that as individuals, as societies, and as a nation, is not that we have by that necessity forces us to do evil by those tragic choices, but that we don't even stop to think about when we're making.